House Bill 2312 to order Wednesday, July 20th. We're only, what, half an hour late, something of that nature?
15.
Can we have Mark McDonald, Brad Berry come up, please, and maybe Dave Schmierbach together? Little Finnish name, huh? Tell us, gentlemen, what you're up to and identify yourselves, please. Up to no good, but other than that.
Do you want to?
I was afraid you'd say that.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, I'm Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I am also a legislative chair for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Yeah, I got that right. I had to think about what I was. We are here to discuss issues related to the DNA PCR bill, and I'm not sure kind of where you want us to start. I know we've talked about some other proposals.
I think we need to know the conceptual idea that you have that you're trying to work out that addresses what you've identified as a potential problem of people who have pled when the other part of the other charges may have been dismissed. That kind of that part of it.
Yeah, I can or you can. Go ahead, Mark.
Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Chair Burdick, my name is Mark McDonald, Senior Deputy District Attorney from Multnomah County. First of all, I think the District Attorney Association would prefer the House version, but if there is going to be a concurrence with the Senate version, we have proposed an amendment, and it addresses the problem of one fairly infamous case. It's involving Ronald Ray Weaver. Mr. Weaver is an individual known as the T-shirt rapist. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, he raped in excess of 50 women in the Portland metropolitan area, Multnomah, Clackamas, Clark counties. These were home invasions. They were forcible rapes, very, very serious cases. Cases were brought in all three counties in part of a plea agreement. He pled guilty to rape charges, two charges in Clackamas County, two in Multnomah, and the other cases were dismissed, including those in Clark County. He was sentenced to 70 years in the state penitentiary with a minimum sentence of 35 years. After his sentence, he attempted, my understanding is he attempted to withdraw his guilty pleas. He was denied that by the trial court, the appellate courts. They both said that his pleas were knowingly and voluntarily entered. And by the way, one of the factors is that they said he got the benefit of the bargain, that these other cases went away. He tried to get his conviction set aside and post-conviction relief, and he was unsuccessful. Then he brought a federal habeas corpus, and 20 years later, federal magistrate in Portland set aside his convictions because they said he had inadequate counsel. So prosecutors in Multnomah County and Clackamas counties were set with the very difficult task of trying to re-prosecute these cases some 20 years later. We literally had a search across the country to find the victims of Mr. Weaver and let them know to their great horror that these convictions have been set aside, that Mr. Weaver may get out of the penitentiary, and that they may or may not have to testify some 20 years later against Mr. Weaver. But the really sort of double troubling thing is that the fact, because the statute of limitations had run on these other cases in which he had pled guilty to, that we were not able to prosecute these other cases. We were limited to the four cases in which he pled guilty. And as you might be expected, evidence was lost. I understand that there was a fingerprint that was destroyed, that people's memories fade. And about of the four cases, only one of the victims is now willing to prosecute against Mr. Weaver. What our amendment essentially does is put the parties back to square one. If a guilty plea is set aside, that you start exactly in the position that you started up in the beginning. Now, again, we prefer the House version because we think that this is going to be very expensive. We're still going to have to retain this evidence for a long period of time. And in every case, and, you know, in a perfect world, we'd like to keep the evidence for that long period of time, but we deal in practical reality, so we're going to have to make difficult choices of what cases to keep the evidence in and what cases we will not. Now, briefly, we've discussed with representatives of the ACLU and Oregon Criminal Defense Association about a further compromise. Conceptually, I think we talked about that instead of having no statute limitations, that we'd have an extended statute of limitations, that essentially the statute conceptually would toll during that period of time if a conviction is overturned. And I think conceptually we're in agreement. I think we just need to come down with specific language.
If I might add to that, what we're talking is the general language that Mr. McDonald brought with him basically says everything comes back. You just start over. And thus all those cases which today statute of limitations would preclude you from bringing back, now it says it has an unlimited statute of limitations and they could all come back and you start over. What the ACLU and OCDLA worried about is if you say unlimited, then that means you could wait forever to bring it back. And we tended to concur. Perhaps once it's remanded to trial court, then a new two-year statute would begin to run. So you have 2 years to find your witnesses, find your victims, and determine what you can and can't proceed on at that point. And that certainly then puts an end gate on it, but allows the state adequate time to prepare and reassert those original claims.
Senator Burdick?
Thank you. In your understanding, would this apply to cases that are within the statute of limitations already when the bill goes into effect? Or let's say you have a case, a 20-year-old case, that the statute of limitation is long since expired in the other offenses that were dismissed. So when this bill goes into effect, the statute of limitations is already expired. Would you think this would apply to those, or would it only apply to cases that are either brought after this bill goes into effect or cases where the statute of limitations in the other offenses is still running? I talked to Mr. Bradley about this point, and I just wanted to get something on the record.
Well, I have to, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I have to admit I haven't briefed this, but my recollection of the cases have said that once the statute of limitations has actually run, you can't resurrect it. That's just my recollection of those cases. And the situation that I recall the cases dealt with was extending the statute of limitations in regards to sexual offenses. And that in recent years, the legislature has passed some bills that extended cases involving children and people that were below a certain age, and that the cases said that if the statute had actually run, you couldn't go back and later resurrect it. So I don't know the answer to that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I think we might want to explore that so we're clear about what we're doing in terms of our policy, because I agree with the concern that if someone is, you know, charged with 10 serious crimes and they plead out on one of them and then they get exonerated, that, you know, they could be very guilty of some of the others and yet you never get a chance to pursue those. So we just need to know what we're doing and whether it does apply to things where the statute is already expired when the bill goes into effect.
Well, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, the other thing it might do is might prevent some frivolous claims being filed, as well as that they know that if people are going back to square one.
Right. And then you're not concerned, because double jeopardy would only apply if there had been a trial. And it was, if someone does a plea agreement and then the others are dismissed, you're not concerned about double jeopardy?
No, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. No, this only applies to guilty pleas. It doesn't apply to people who are acquitted of other counts. It only be applied to where there was a conviction based upon a guilty plea.
Or dismissal.
Or dismissal.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else, committee members?
Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Mr. McDonald, you spoke about the T-shirt rapist. Let's use a different example. There was a pretty famous case in Massachusetts where the Armalts were convicted of child abuse, and this is an ongoing thing for years. I think a gentleman spent 15 or 20 years of his life in jail for alleged child abuse, the case was finally overturned after great expense and effort by the district attorney. Some people considered that a vendetta by the district attorney. Under this amendment that you propose here, would that provide leave for that district attorney to charge the Armalt with any of those cases, any related cases?
Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, first of all, I'm not familiar with that particular case, so it's somewhat difficult. I think what's going to be incumbent upon prosecutors in taking guilty pleas is know what cases are actually being dismissed and what cases are not being brought, and those would have to be identified at the time the plea was entered. And I would foresee that would be doing by reference either to a department incident number, because all police cases have an incident number that they're referred to. But these are the cases that we are not bringing. And I think, I think it'd be incumbent upon the state to do that when the guilty plea was entered. I would also be objectionable to somebody coming back and then trying to load things on later on. I think that would be highly improper and irregular. I just want to emphasize to the members of the committee is that I know from my office, and I think for prosecutors generally, that we don't want to convict anybody that's innocent. We don't want to do that. And my office has a proven history of trying to exonerate people that have been convicted. One of the cases used as an example by the ACLU was the Pavlenek case. We were very aggressive in overturning that conviction. We went to the governor's office, we petitioned the governor, and despite the fact that was not a DNA case, despite the fact that we had very deep concerns that maybe Ms. Pavlenek was a participant in that murder, but because the preponderance of the evidence seemed to show that somebody else was responsible, we act very aggressively to overturn that conviction so an innocent person wasn't behind bars.
May I address that? Chair and Senator Whitsitt and members of the committee, I too am not familiar with that case you mentioned, but I think the overall plan that we are at least talking about today would bring you back to what was charged before. So I assume if that district attorney had really piled on the charges up front, they would have had to have been defended up front also, and that's all that would come back. It would not allow you to go back and bring back charges that had not been brought. You don't create this unlimited statute of limitations for whatever, charged and uncharged. It's only those that have been charged and dismissed that you would come back to. So if you'd filed 10 charges, for example, initially, pled to 2 and 8 were dismissed, you'd come back and now face all 10. But no more. You wouldn't be able to bring more. That's as I envision what we've been talking to. I, too, would like to reiterate what Mr. McDonald said about district attorneys not wanting people who are innocent to be jailed. And we had a case also where I was notified that some children witnesses had been coerced into testifying on a case. And that case, if I'm remembering correctly, I know it happened very quickly, but within 10 days of my actually hearing about it from my deputy, who the officers came back to and said, we heard this, within 10 days we had those children interviewed and polygraphed, had met with the defendant who was in prison, and she was out. And we did everything to get her out. We brought it into court. In fact, the judge said, what's your basis for allowing her out? and it was one of those, Judge, we need to figure out a way to do it. If it means totally dismissing or whatever we have to do, or joint motion to withdraw, or change verdict, or whatever it took. But we did that. And I think all of my 35 colleagues as district attorneys would see their obligation as doing the same.
Mr. Chair.
Well, just to follow up, the Amaral case in Massachusetts was just that. It was a coerced testimony by children, and it took Mr. Amaral almost 20 years to get out of prison. So I empathize with your position, and I trust that the district attorneys in Oregon are all straightforward and upright. But in this particular situation, it did not work. You know, it's basically the same situation that you said you resolved in 10 days. It took this 20 years, and this was a whole family that had run a school. They got them overturned one by one by one, and it was a whole national issue before it was done. So, anyway, thank you.
Any members?
Yes, Chair. I just wanted to follow up on what you and Ms. McDonald just put on the record, because I wanted to put it on the record, too, that I don't see this at all about being any kind of reflection on our criminal justice system. I think the law enforcement community, by and large, and the whole legal community in Oregon, really works hard to make sure that you're not putting innocent people in jail. My interest in this issue is just in terms of our criminal justice system. There has to be, for the credibility of the system, there has to be a safety valve for when, despite all of our best efforts, all of our hardest work, and sometimes dealing with people who are just flat out not being honest, that mistakes are made. I just think it adds solidity to our criminal justice system, and that we need to structure it in a way that we are not inadvertently putting guilty people back out on the street.
Senator Gordon?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I apologize for my delay.
We're all late.
Okay. There was a meeting of the Senate's Budget Committee, and that is the reason for my late arrival. And I also am going to apologize if the question I want to pose has already been posed to this panel. I'm reading from communication that I received from the ACLU, and there's a paragraph that says, 4 years ago, the district attorneys argued that passage of this law would open up the door to abuse and an impossible number of requests, so we put a sunset on the law to review it. We are now back 4 years later, and the result is that despite the concerns of the DAs, no one has used the law. By that, no one has even sought access to it on the front end, let alone triggered its full process. This has not been a vehicle for abuse, and part of the reason why is how the law is structured to set up safeguards at the front end. Now the DAs argue that by expanding this law, it will lead to abuse, despite the fact that this concern turned out to be unfounded 4 years ago. We are happy to include a sunset provision to allow review of this law in 2 years' time. Could you speak to what has been expressed by ACLU?
Certainly, Senator Gordley, members of the committee. First of all, the Senate version changes the fact that identity is really an issue in the original case. So that was one of the safeguards, I think, that they were talking about that cut down on the cost. The second is that there hasn't been many cases, and there haven't, or if there's been even one, I'm really not sure. But there are costs that are not as directly obvious. Those are the costs of retaining evidence indefinitely. And that is a huge cost to law enforcement. I get requests from the property room all the time, and this is sort of the conflict that between law enforcement that most members of the public usually don't see. And I'm saying, save it. You got to save it. You got to keep this evidence forever. And they says, well, we don't have any room. Well, we got evidence to the rafters. We got to get rid of stuff. I know the crime labs tells me that all the time, or they can't do additional tests. So there are associated costs that are not directly obvious to everyone else. And those are real costs that we deal with every day.
Senator Gorley, members of the committee, if I could address just a couple of comments to that. When this the DNA PCR bill was originally passed that you discussed, I think there was a belief that there were many people waiting to file these challenges, that they were there, and thus the original sunset was at least in part designed to say, okay, we'll have these people, they can make their challenges and be done. And I think there have been fewer than we expected. However, and we didn't discuss before you got here, Senator, about the no contest guilty pleas. I'm sure you expected us to, but we were sidetracked. That, I think, opens a door that would, in fact, invite abuse. And if nothing else, I would cite you to the numbers of cases that are on appeal and already on post-conviction relief from those who entered pleas of guilty, who swore under oath they were guilty, and those who entered pleas of no contest to the court after being fully advised that that means you will be found guilty. They made that choice. And then they go ahead and apply for appeal, and then they challenge the competency of their lawyers. And I would suggest that those who would attempt to manipulate the system even on a guilty plea may be the ones that you will find will be filing these. I don't know the statewide record on the filing of the DNA PCR. We've had one in my county, and it was a case that was inappropriately filed, not within the statute, and we had to pay for a lawyer to represent the defendant to assist in the preparation of that. We paid for time in my office, several hours filing briefs, responding to it and saying how it was not appropriately taken and actually did not fit within the statute. So it clearly was a bending of the statute as far as it would go just to bring this matter before the court. And my concern, and I said it before to you, Senator Gordon, when we talked about this extension, is that we will have those people who there is no question about their guilt and that they swore under oath that they're guilty, and now we'll attempt to resurrect their case in the future. That's where our concern is.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, did the other gentleman wish to respond? And I apologize for not recognizing you, sir.
Representative Krieger, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, for the record, my name is David Schmerbach. I'm the director of the Forensic Services Division, the Oregon State Police. And I don't know if I want to address just your comment or the question before the whole panel, but we're here today in support of a post-conviction relief bill. However, since there are insufficient resources in the Forensic Services Division to do all the DNA testing right now, this is a question of economics for us. And we estimated for you in a publication I provided to each of your offices the costs on this bill as a dash B amendment. Some of the discussion here today further makes me anxious because you're opening up even more cases to potential DNA testing. If all of the cases that were part of the plea deal now become active cases again. We're currently pending about 400 cases in the DNA unit. One analyst can do about 95 a year. We're adding to that pending list about 30 to 40 a month. So this is just going to add to that problem. What makes these types of cases unique is they come in under court order. They can move right to the front of the pack, which you may argue that that's where they should be, but any current case will be set aside to work these cases. And that's our concern, is the lack of the ability to triage and prioritize them and the fiscal impact. I will point out that the kits themselves are paid for under the indigent expense funds. The main expense here is salaries for staffing. That's what I'm presenting today. If there are specific questions for me, I'll be happy to answer them.
Senator Wissett.
Thank you, Chair Krieger. Just to follow up on Senator Gordley's question, do the district attorneys or the crime labs not keep evidence from guilty pleas to serious crimes against persons now?
Senator Wissett, members of the committee, My office keeps evidence in homicide cases. To my knowledge, it's been some time since I've worked in a sexual assault unit. To my knowledge, we don't keep them in other cases. But there might be a time period, but to my knowledge, there isn't.
Senator Whitsitt, members of the committee, in my office, we generally, on sexual assault cases, we too keep everything on homicide cases. We would ask law enforcement to maintain the evidence until the appeal is exhausted or an appeal is not filed. And at that point, then, we would normally say you can dispose of the evidence. I will say the other problem that we haven't addressed directly is that of lost evidence. I can't think of one of my police agencies, and I'm in a medium-sized county. I have three police agencies that have evidence facilities, Newburgh Police Department, McMinnville Police Department, and the Sheriff's Office. And I can tell you all three of them, since I've been DA now in my ninth year, have moved evidence at least once to new facilities and have lost evidence in the process. As careful as they are trying to keep track of everything, they have, you know, notebooks full of evidence sheets that they're trying to key up to cubbies of evidence that are numbered and the like. So that too is an additional problem. Now, as this may come back some 10 years later, that evidence may have been shifted two or three times to different places and can be very difficult to keep track of. That is, in fact, probably a fault of the system. I'm not saying that it should weigh heavily, but when we're talking about evidence retention and maintenance, it is an issue because they will, in time, outgrow their evidence lockers and will have to move them, outgrow the evidence room, outgrow the evidence building in time. Mm-hmm.
And just a short follow-up, wouldn't that work both ways against both your ability to prosecute and also to ability to, or defense to exonerate the individual?
Lost evidence, in my experience, in the vast majority of the cases, probably over 95%, work against the state.
Thank you.
Anything else further? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
We have Adrian Meyer and John Hummel, come up, please.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. As I understand it, there's two main concerns that we've heard regarding the Dash B amendment. First, if you extend the bill to people who pled guilty, that'll open the floodgates to hundreds of filings under this bill. Second, we've heard that innocent people don't really plead guilty, and if someone's pled guilty, they are guilty, and if they file anything, it's just trying to use a legal technicality to get out of their conduct. Well, I'll address both of those. I'll first start with the floodgate argument, and I have a sheet that I'll go over with you. There are significant procedural protections in this bill to assure that the floodgates will not open. I've picked an arbitrary group of 1,000 people just for illustrative purposes here. This is not a scientific study, but it's just to illustrate my argument. Now, let's say we have 1,000 people in the criminal justice system who've pled guilty and want to avail themselves of this new law. Well, let's say 900 of the 1,000 were convicted of one of the hundreds of crimes in our state other than aggravated murder, a person felony, or a sex crime. They could not use the bill. So now we have 100 left. 75 of the remaining 100 are unable to identify a specific piece of evidence that contains DNA from their case. They are not eligible to use the bill. So now we have 25 people left. 12 of those remaining 25, they actually can identify a piece of DNA evidence, but the evidence is no longer in the possession of the state. They cannot use the bill. This bill doesn't require the state to keep evidence. It doesn't change the law regarding evidence retention. So now we have 13 people left. Seven of the remaining 13 can identify a specific piece of evidence. It is in the possession of the state, but their request was not made in a timely manner. They are not eligible. And you'll notice in the brackets, I say to the page and line number of the bill where the language to support that is. So we have six people left. Three of the remaining six, they've made their request in a timely manner. There is DNA evidence. It's in the possession of the state, but there's not a reasonable possibility that it would help exonerate them. They're not eligible. Well, we have three people left. Two of the remaining three are out of custody. They don't want to pay for the test. If you're out of custody, you have to pay for the test. They're not eligible. We're down to one person. That person's in custody. There's DNA evidence that can prove their innocence. They're convicted of one of the crimes that are listed in the bill. They submit the request. The evidence is tested. They're proved to be innocent. They walk out the doors of that prison cell, and every single person on this committee will be proud when they read about that and see it on the news that you supported this bill. The procedural protections will control against the floodgates opening. I hope you see that from that example. Now, the second thing we hear is that innocent people aren't pleading guilty. Well, let me tell you this. I agree with Mr. Berry and Mr. McDonald that I've never met, and I can't imagine there's a DA out there who's sought out an innocent person to prosecute. Every DA who prosecutes someone thinks they're guilty. And I tell you this, every jury who finds someone guilty thinks that person's guilty. And every judge who sentences that person thinks that person's guilty. And I believe that in my heart. But we now see, due to DNA evidence, that hundreds, if not thousands, of innocent people have been set free. And they haven't been set free from the grasp of ruthless DAs who were prosecuting people who they thought were innocent. They were set free because of the great science that helps set free people who were wrongly convicted through no fault of anyone and through no ill will on anyone's part. I have a law review article that I won't go over now, but this talks about the problem of innocent people pleading guilty, and it gives some examples of that. I'll hand that out. There's specific examples of people who are innocent, who confessed, who pled guilty, and who were exonerated through DNA evidence. Now, let me give you a little example of what happens. It happens to me on occasion, not often, but I'm a criminal defense attorney. Here's what occasionally happens in my office. And I'm going to play two roles here, the defense attorney and the defendant. I have experience with one of those roles, not the other. But, all right, let's say I have a client who, his name is Joe. He's charged with rape in the first degree. If he's found guilty, he does 100 months in prison. It's a Measure 11 offense. He comes to my office and he tells me he didn't do it. He wasn't even there. It's a wrong identification. He was in another state. I hire a private investigator. We interview 50 witnesses. I look at the state's evidence. It's a toss-up. It's a toss-up. He's telling me he didn't do it. The state has some witnesses who are identifying him. The identification maybe isn't that strong. It's a close case. The prosecution gives a plea offer. Let's say you plead guilty. You can do 10 months. And here's the conversation I have with my client. Joe, we got a plea offer. It's 10 months. If you take it, you do 10 months. You have to do some sex offender counseling. You'll be on probation. There'll be a small fine. Or we can go to trial. If you win, you're free. If you lose, you're doing 100 months. What do you want to do? I can't do that. I didn't do it. I'm innocent. I was in the other state. All my friends know that. All my family knows that. I'm innocent. I'm not pleading to anything. Joe, I hear you, brother. I've looked at the evidence. You can win, and you could lose. It's your call. I'm not going to twist your arm, but it's your call. If we go to trial, you're doing 100 months, and you got to think about your family and your little two-year-old son, and he's going to grow up without a father, and you think about it. And he goes, well, what about that eyewitness ID? That person who was 100 yards away, they're claiming that they can be sure it's me. So I know, that's the weakest part of their case, that eyewitness ID. But if the jury believes that guy, you lose. At that point, it's 100 months, and the judge has no choice. Well, Mr. Hummel, what about that DNA evidence? That's going to show there was DNA evidence. Well, Joe, we had that tested. We sent it out to the lab. There wasn't a large enough sample. They couldn't get a match. You know, maybe in 10 years, DNA evidence will be able to test a sample that small, but it can't now. And he thinks about it, and he stews. You know what he finally says? I'll take it, but I'm not pleading guilty. I can't go in front of that judge and say I'm guilty. I'll plead no contest. And then I tell him, you know, that's not an option. I talked to the prosecutor and I said, you know, the only hope of this guy being able to take a deal is if you let him plead no contest and do 10 months. And Joe, the prosecutor, said no. It's a guilty plea or nothing. And then he thinks about it. And what do you do then? You're innocent. You going to risk it? You going to roll the dice? Some people don't roll the dice. And they go in and plead guilty, even though they're not guilty. And many prosecutors and deputy district attorneys in this state require guilty pleas, particularly in sex abuse cases, and they're doing it for the right reasons. I can appreciate where they're coming from. They think it's only fair to the victim to see the defendant go up there and say, I did it. And if the defendant goes up there and pleads no contest, the defendant didn't take responsibility. So the prosecutor feels that it's important to the victim to see that sense of accountability. So I understand where the district attorneys are coming from, but it results in the occasional situation where an innocent person will plead guilty. And it's really interesting, this case, because we had DNA evidence, but it couldn't be tested. Now, 5 years down the road, if DNA has advanced to the point where that small bit of DNA could be tested, and if it was tested, it would show that this person was innocent, how can anyone stand in the way of that? We ask that 2312-B amendment be passed, and I will briefly talk about the amendment that we heard about. The amendment was just discussed with me by Mr. Berry and Mr. McDonald before they came up here, and we certainly, conceptually, we support the concept. When we heard the testimony, it was a little different than conceptually what I supported. I thought we were talking about cases that were dismissed pursuant to this DNA bill. If someone gets a DNA test and the charge is dismissed, could the other charges be brought back? And conceptually, my organization supports that. What I heard the testimony was that the DA's proposal would be for every case out there, separate from, not limited to DNA testing, if there's other plea negotiations going on in non-DNA testing cases, that their proposed amendment would control. I'm not able to take a position on that at this point. That would be a huge sea change in criminal justice law, and I'd like to think about that at least for more than the half an hour I've had now, but I will commit now on the DNA bill. If we want to say, if you avail yourself of this DNA bill, your conviction's overturned, but other cases were dismissed, that those can come back. Conceptually, we support that. We'd have to work on the language. But so, thank you, Chair.
Andrea? Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. Thank you all for being here today and for moving forward on this bill. I know you've heard a lot of testimony. Well, actually, Senator Gordley, you've had the fortune of, or disfortune of, missing some of the very, there's been a lot of testimony on both sides of the building, and I appreciate your thoughtful consideration. We do strongly endorse the Bean Gross version of the bill. We think it is the right thing to do. I'm not going to repeat all my testimony that I've given, but I want to emphasize 2 points. Because I spent some time highlighting this bill. I mean, the first hurdle for all of you when you look at this is the statute's written kind of a mucky way that makes it hard to process the procedures and safeguards here. So I want to highlight a few of them. The motion requesting the DNA is limited, as Mr. Hummel said, to those for aggravated murder and person felonies, so there's that limitation. The motion must be supported by an affidavit, and that affidavit must contain the statement that the person is innocent of the offense or for the underlying conduct and underlying a mandatory sentence enhancement. They must also identify the specific evidence, and they must identify a theory of defense. That specific evidence must be secured in connection with the prosecution. They must include the results of a previous DNA test, and then they must make a showing, a prima facie showing, that the specific evidence would, assuming exculpatory results, establish actual innocence. Then the court takes a look at this, and the court must make a finding that all the things I've already articulated have actually been met. They may not be, in which case that ends the process. The court must ensure that the evidence was subject to chain of custody, that the motion was made in a timely manner, and for the purposes of demonstrating the innocence of the person of the offense or of the conduct, and not to delay the execution of the sentence or administration of justice. In other words, again, another safeguard for the court to ensure that someone is not abusing this process. It will be stopped. And finally, the court, if they do grant this motion, may impose reasonable conditions designed to protect the interests of the state in the integrity of the evidence and the testing process. The other issue raised was related to sort of the cost and retention issue by the DAs. I think what we've heard and a concern that the ACLU has, and I think we all should have, is the lack of any real policies and procedures around retention of evidence across the state. I mean, Mr. Berry, I believe, testified that some evidence is lost. This bill doesn't change that. It doesn't go into that issue. I think as a legislature, we need to look at that during the interim. There's fiscal connected to that, but as a matter of ensuring both convictions and the use of DNA to convict people and to exonerate people and the whole system that DNA has evolved in the last 5 or 10 years, we really should be looking at that. But this bill makes no change to any duty or obligation to maintain or retain evidence. If it is not there to be tested, that is the end of the motion and the process for which the person could pursue. They have no cause of action. That is the end. Finally, we just saw the amendments, the conceptual or somewhat typed up amendments from the DA. And let me be clear about our position. This appears to amend the statute of limitations section, ORS 131-125. We cannot support that. As Mr. Hummel said, this opens up a whole much bigger issue. It opens an issue that the DAs and others should have brought forward prior to this in a separate bill dealing with that. There have been statute of limitations legislation in this session. However, with that said, like Mr. Hummel and the OCDLA, we have no objection to language put specifically tied to this statute to ensure that if someone were exonerated and there were other charges that had been dismissed or pled out or in some other way resolved to which there is meritorious need to bring them back, that can be done within a reasonable amount of time. And we would not oppose that, although we think it's unnecessary, but if it's a safeguard to make everyone feel more comfortable, we would only support that if it's limited to the DNA process set up in this separate statute. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I, again, appreciate this committee's energy and attention on this issue.
A couple things come to mind. We've been here an hour and something. We're talking about a conceptual amendment, so you can't question anything definite to a point. Talking to Senator Burdick, if she's willing, I'd like to have you work with staff and the gentleman there in the back and see if you cannot come up with legislation, an amendment that is specific to this bill and fits within the relating clause.
Okay.
And right. Any comments regarding that or any further suggestions other than that, Senator Burdick?
Well, I just I want to thank the DAs for bringing this forward, this approach, because there are some issues that are different with a guilty plea, and that is that other charges for which a person may very well be guilty are often dismissed and in the interest of moving the process along. And I really appreciate your willingness, Mr. Hummel, to work with them to get something that will fit within the context of this bill and will also limit the statute of limitations to a set period after this process goes into effect. I fully expect that we're going to see about the same kind of participation that we've seen before. But I just think in terms of the credibility of our justice system, we need a safety valve for those very, very rare cases where, despite everyone's best efforts, justice is not served, and justice is not served if someone who is guilty of other offenses is able to use this to escape accountability for things that they actually did.
Chair Krieger, Senator Burdick, I think actually from our perspective, the term we would like to use is tolling the statute, not necessarily extending the statute, but tolling it after the charges are brought during a certain period of time. I mean, looking at that perspective, we'd be concerned about potentially allowing the statute of limitations to continue when it had already tolled or ended before charges were even brought. We're not using this as a grab. We simply, if I'm understanding the committee right, the direction is if when the charges were brought and then the person goes through the process and pleads and they are exonerated, that within a very narrow period of time, the charges can be renewed that were brought. We obviously would want that to be
in connection with the charge that they've been exonerated.
To which they may have done a plea agreement.
The whole plea package. Basically, right. I think the DA's phrase that go back to square one. Go back to where you were before the guilty plea was made and have a limited period of time.
Anything further, committee?
Hopefully we're all...
We'll work.
And in terms of bringing this back and hopefully moving it forward? Is it
hopefully
your intention?
You can get something to us by Monday afternoon.
Well, August 31st, when we have our Democrat school bill comes back.
That might be an idea.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Committee, we're adjourned.
Thank you.